There are some students who are just not ready for college, and that makes a huge difference in their future.
College has become this incredibly important time for defining the trajectory of the rest of our lives.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear how our college years can make us or break us. We'll also look at school-based health centers and spend an academic minute with everyone's hero, Mom. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Does college still work? Is the system designed to help just the privileged and leave everyone else behind? Or can a college education today provide real opportunity to young Americans? Those are the questions Paul Tough tries to answer in his new book, The Years That Matter Most: How College Makes or Breaks Us. Paul Tough is an author, contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, and a regular contributor to the public radio program This American Life. He spoke to the Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue about his new book and why he took on the project.
Well, I guess it's two things. I mean, one is I am really interested in this idea of mobility in America, how young people from modest backgrounds are able to achieve great things, to succeed beyond where their family has been in the past. And what I hear from economists is that these years, more so than anywhere else in the world and more so than any other period in the past, are right now in the United States the ones that matter. College has become this incredibly important time for defining the trajectory of the rest of our lives. The other reason was just on a personal level. Like, talking to young people who are in the middle of that process for me is just fascinating. And so the most fun part of the reporting was getting to meet and talk to lots of young people who were trying to make their way through this often very confusing system.
So in doing that, where do you go? Where do you go to find the answers to these questions?
All over. So I went to 21 states in my reporting. And so mostly I was talking to young people from in that sort of at the end of high school and the beginning of college. But then I was also trying to understand the sort of expert and institutional point of view. So I spoke to a lot of economists. There's this economist named Raj Chetty at Harvard who has done remarkable work on understanding how mobility works in the United States today. I talked to admissions officers. I talked to people who ran welding programs at community colleges. I tried to get a full portrait of this complicated landscape of higher ed today.
One of the things that I found so interesting in the book is how open the students are to talk about this, that it's very much on their mind as well.
For sure, yeah. I mean, I think it's hard. I mean, mobility is this really important force in sort of like politics and economic life, right? This ability to change your state in life and to rise above your parents. But for an actual individual person, it's really hard. No matter how much you want it and no matter how good it is in the long run, you're in many ways leaving your family behind. You're turning your back on your past. It makes you very confused about your place in the world and your place in the culture. And so I think for a lot of students, they were feeling stressed and bewildered by what they were experiencing and wanted to talk about it. And so being able to have those conversations as these young people were right in the middle of that process was kind of amazing.
You make the point in the book that the students that really have it especially hard are those if you come from a family without a lot of money. All along the way, at every stage of the college process, can be more difficult, more challenging because of the economics.
Yeah, and so I just kept finding this. So the big picture is there's this remarkable level of stratification in higher education today. So at the most selective institutions, Ivy League colleges and similar institutions, the vast majority of the student body is made up of wealthy students, and it's very rare for low-income students to be admitted. But even beyond those sort of big-picture stratification, there are all these little ways that it is more difficult to be low-income. I mean, certainly paying for college is a lot harder when you don't have a lot of money in your family. But even things like sports, like I hadn't understood this, that the way that so many colleges, especially private small colleges, recruit athletes is they are more likely to recruit athletes who have taken part in a sport in high school that's pretty expensive. You know, things like tennis and golf and squash and lacrosse, things that have already a high barrier to entry. So in addition to the sort of obvious ways that it's hard to be a low-income college student, there are a lot of hidden ones as well that I was able to explore.
Does the system work better for kids who are from well-off families?
Well, in some ways it certainly does. Institutionally, it's definitely easier to make your way through the system if you have money, if you can pay for college, if you can pay for things like SAT tutors and college coaches, the admissions process becomes a lot easier. But on a deeper level, on sort of an emotional and psychological level, I think that those students have it pretty hard in the process as well. I spent a lot of time reporting on an SAT tutor in suburban Washington, D.C., an excellent teacher who teaches mostly affluent kids in that part of the world. They were getting this incredible leg up from his teaching. Their scores were going way up, and they were getting into much better colleges as a result. But they were also totally stressed out. I mean, they were working tremendously hard. Their whole junior and senior years were focused on just getting these test scores higher so they could get into the college of their choice or sometimes of their parents' choice. And so I think the reality is that that is a pretty rough way to spend your adolescence. So in a strange way, I feel like this system doesn't serve those young people any better than it serves low-income students.
That SAT tutor that you read about, Ned Johnson, but there are a lot of Ned Johnsons out in the world, aren't there?
There sure are, yeah.
And as you say, they can add a layer, certainly, because it adds a layer of stress and anxiety to the student, but they are also very precise in, okay, this is what you need to pass this test or to do well in this test.
Yeah, the thing that I found so fascinating about what Ned did is that, so he was certainly helping his students understand the SAT and the ACT and figuring out how to do better. But a lot of his approach was kind of psychological. His theory, and I think he's right, is that one of the reasons that students don't get higher scores on those tests is just because they're anxious, they're freaked out. These tests put an enormous amount of pressure on students. Students put pressure on themselves. And when they get there, they often freeze up. And so much of what he was doing was trying to get students to think of these tests as just sort of a game, to not take them so seriously. And that in doing that, it gave them a certain sense of power over these tests. And somewhat paradoxically, once they calmed down, they actually would do much better.
I guess it brings you also to the question of how accurate and how good are these tests at determining a student's intelligence, their smarts to get into college? Are they a good bellwether?
I mean, they certainly are a useful predictor in some ways. So when people who have studied this say that the SAT is a decent predictor of how well a student will do in college, but it's not as good a predictor as high school grades. So right. If you just look at either one alone, high school grades are a better predictor. So the people like the College Board say, well, if you add this one extra number, it's going to be more helpful. And what people who are skeptical about the test say in response is that in getting that little bit of extra certainty, what you also get is a lot of inequality, that high school grades don't really favor well-off kids, but SAT scores do. And so the more that an institution puts emphasis on SAT scores in admissions, the easier it's going to be for them to admit a lot of rich kids and the harder it's going to be for them to admit low-income first-generation students.
There's a fascinating part in the book where you talk to these kids that, look, they didn't like high school very much and they're really not excited about going to college.
Yeah, that was sort of the reporting that was the biggest struggle for me, because the answers really aren't clear. You know, the economy has just changed, and it's changed in a way that just having a high school diploma and going out into the workforce is a pretty bad idea. There are very few opportunities available to young people who don't have anything beyond a high school degree. And yet, you know, the reality is there's a lot of kids who, yeah, didn't love school and aren't particularly dying to go to college. And we have done, I think, a terrible job of providing young people in that circumstance, and there's a lot of them, with any good options. You know, we have been cutting back on our funding for community colleges and other sorts of training programs. And so those kids really don't have a lot of options. And I don't think the option is no college. I don't think the option is four-year college, but we haven't done a good job of giving them options in between.
I guess you probably can't have this conversation without talking about the college admissions scandal. And I'm less interested in, of course, the sensationalism of that, and more interested in what do you think it tells us about the process, especially at the very elite schools, and how pure it is. And should we as students and or consumers be cynical of it?
Well, I mean, what struck me is that those parents who got caught up in the scandal, they certainly were cynical about it. I spent some time reading the wiretap transcripts when the FBI tapped the phones of this corrupt college coach, Rick Singer, while he was talking to all these parents. And what struck me was that, so here are these, you know, incredibly affluent and powerful parents, and they knew that the game was rigged. And they also understood that it was mostly rigged for them and for people like them. But because I think it felt unfair, it didn't seem wrong to them, though clearly it was. They were clearly breaking the law. It didn't seem wrong to them to just do one more thing on top of everything they were already doing to get their kids into, you know, a highly selective college. So I think that scandal is a real early warning alarm. Maybe not that early. Maybe we already kind of knew this. But I think it made it more clear that things are really unfair in higher education admissions at those selective institutions. I don't think there are a lot of people doing what those parents did, but everything up to that point, all of the stuff that is totally legal, has made for a really uneven playing field.
Do you think it changes what the colleges are doing and help them work on their game as far as realizing some of the people on the outside who were very much influencing these decisions?
I think colleges have made some useful sort of small-scale reforms, I think especially in athletics, which a lot of those parents were using as a sort of backdoor way in. So I do feel like they've made some small reforms, but I think there are some bigger reforms that they need to pay attention to. And, you know, I don't think that admissions offices believed that the system was totally fair, or they, it's not like they don't know that most of the wealthy students who are applying to their colleges are using SAT tutors who are increasing their scores. One of the things that I found, I did some reporting among admissions people watching as admissions directors try to deal with all the pressures that they face to bring in the right class each year. It's not so easy. You know, it's not just a meritocracy. They have to choose students who can pay, they feel, in order to make their budget. There are a lot of colleges that are financially underwater right now. So I do think that it was in some ways a useful wake-up call for them, but in lots of ways I think they understood the way the system was working all too well already.
You make the point that your book is not a policy book, and it is a book of stories and ideas, but you do come to conclusions.
I do, and I think I sort of come to two conclusions when I think about what I think should change. And one is that I feel like among those highly selective institutions, the ones that actually can afford to admit more low-income students, they just need to change their policies. There's lots that they can do to admit more excellent low-income students. And, you know, the problem is that these are private institutions, so there's not much that the rest of us can do except try to make them feel bad about the way that they are running their admissions right now and hope that they will change their ways. And I think there are individuals, you know, alumni and students and parents and staff at those institutions that can push them. But the bigger picture, and I think the one that concerns all of us as citizens, not just as students and parents and professors, is the public side of higher education. And, you know, not that long ago, public higher education was seen as this incredibly important force in American life, the thing that we were providing to give opportunity to millions of young people every year. And just over the last couple of decades, we have pulled back in our public funding of higher education by a remarkable degree. Exactly at a moment when it's clear, there are clear signs from the job market that our young people need more and more education. And so that's the big thing that we can change. We can invest again in public higher education. And that doesn't just mean four-year degrees. It means community colleges and training programs and public universities of all kinds. But that system is you know, this is what every other developed country is doing, is putting lots of money into their public university system. We need to do the same thing if we want to, first of all, keep up with our competitors, and second, have a more fair nation.
There's so much about it that seems to be struggling. Of course, the high cost of college and students dealing with the debt, but also the large number of colleges, and we've seen a huge number just in the past year, they're going out of business. They can't afford to keep their doors open.
Yeah, I know. I think we, especially parents who are paying those incredible tuition bills, it's hard to imagine that colleges can't keep afloat with that kind of money coming in. But it's absolutely true. You know, they're not getting as much from tuition, especially from affluent students, as they used to. And there are really a lot of colleges. I think the statistic I cite in my book is that a quarter of private American colleges right now are underwater financially. They're in the red. They're paying more than they take in each year. So it's a serious problem, and it's especially a serious problem when it comes to admissions, because those private institutions really do have a hard time thinking about equity and fairness in their admissions when they have to think so much about just bringing enough tuition money to stay afloat.
So where does your optimism lie?
Well, my optimism lies in a couple of ways. One is there were individual young people who I met and reported on. I think of this one young woman named Yvonne Martinez, who is a math student at the University of Texas. She's from a low-income family in San Antonio, and I watched her as she went through her freshman calculus class, which is a super important class if you want to be a math major, as she did. And she really struggled because she hadn't had great math education in her low-income high school, but she worked very hard, and she got great support from her professor and from the institution, and she ended up succeeding and is now on her way to a degree in advanced mathematics. So there is the possibility, the likelihood, that students like her can succeed if they're given the right sort of support.
Again, the name of Paul Tough's new book is The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Still to come, getting health care in schools is becoming more common around the country. That story next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. There are nearly 2,000 school-based health centers around the country. Between 2010 and 2013, the Affordable Care Act appropriated a total of $200 million to support, improve, and expand services at school-based health centers. One state that has embraced the concept is West Virginia. Kelly Caseman is the executive director and a founding member of Think Kids in West Virginia. I caught up with her at a seminar, and we talked about school-based health centers.
A school-based health center is pretty self-explanatory. It's a health center that's located either in the school or on school grounds, so kids have close access to health care without having to leave the premises of their school.
And in your state of West Virginia, there seems to be more than most states, right?
We do. We have more per capita than any state in the country. So we have nearly 170, which is around 25% of all of our schools are served by a school-based health center.
Why is that in West Virginia? How come?
So many years ago, when the coal industry was booming in our state, we had a lot of black lung clinics. And in the 70s, federally qualified health centers were established, and they morphed into FQHC. So we have a robust network of school-based health centers due to them being sponsored by the FQHCs.
Where does the funding for this come from?
So it's mostly due to billing. So they ensure that kids have insurance once they come in and use the facility, and then they bill the insurance. So that is how they sustain. They have some philanthropic funding for some grant programs, but mostly primary care, mental health care, oral health care is paid for by billing.
How does the relationship with the clinics and the children begin?
So normally when a child starts school, you know how that you get just several pieces of paper for the first day that parents have to sign? So there's a parent permission slip to use the school-based health center that the parent has to sign. If the parent doesn't sign it, it doesn't necessarily mean that they can't use the center. What often happens is something happens in the school and the child needs health care. So the staff will call the parent and get verbal permission and then take the paper home with them to make sure they get signed documentation.
Does each center just serve the one school?
No. So we have some schools with one on campus. So you may have a middle school and a high school that's in one place, and then you'll have the center in the middle so kids can both kind of navigate in. And then you have campuses that may have elementary school to high school. So they may serve several schools.
Who runs these? Who's working in these clinics?
So most of our school-based health centers are run by federally qualified health centers. We have a couple that are run by acute care hospitals. And most of them are staffed by mid-levels, so nurse practitioners or physician assistants. And, of course, they have medical assistants as well as nurses.
And how much are parents involved in this? Can parents actually go to these?
Some can. They differ from center to center. So some school-based health centers actually see the community. They have an outside door where parents can come and go at their leisure. You have some that only see families if there's a particular issue at home, say, for example, strep throat, and they need to check everyone. So they'll go through the school and then use the facility, and then you have some that just see the kids. It really depends and varies from center to center.
Are you limited as to what can be treated at these centers, or is it just, the whole gamut?
Well, it really depends on what the FQHC or the sponsoring agency can provide, what the school will allow. So one of the more controversial services is reproductive health, and it really depends on the community, what they decide services should be provided within that center. So it's really kind of a community engagement, a community decision as to what services they have.
When a child graduates, what happens then? Is there any kind of counseling? Here's how you can get your health care now?
So the hope is if the child stays within the community, they can start using that community health center that's there. So their electronic health record would stay within the community. Our hope with these school-based health centers is that these kids at the same time learn health literacy. So they take some ownership of their own health care. We know that college students have a tendency to not access health care as needed. They wind up in the ER like others who don't access preventive services. So the hope is that with a robust network of school-based health centers, kids learn how to access health care appropriately. They keep control of their health records, and that when they transition out, when they, fly the nest, so to speak, they can be better consumers of their own health care.
Is there anything unique to West Virginia that you probably wouldn't see maybe in Oregon?
Well, definitely the network of the school-based health centers, the network of FQHCs, the fact that we don't rely on philanthropic billing to sustain our school-based health centers. And I think that a lot of it has to do with we have grassroots support of them. So I think a lot of states have to look from the top down for their support, and we're really from the ground up. So we can really grow and nurture our school-based health centers to, perhaps they start with just providing primary health care. We try to build them up, provide your mental health care, provide your oral health care, and then really kind of cultivate advocates from those centers so we can then inform our legislators about what's happening on that ground level so we can advocate for better policy, better reform, and more services.
Is there much support in the legislature for this?
There is. I would have to say we have a lot of support, but we have that cursory support or peripheral support where they understand what a school-based health center is, but not the complexities of the issues that we're dealing with. The opioid crisis has just created, an epidemic of different needs and crises within the state for our kids. You know, being removed from the home is a very traumatic experience, for example. Starting a new school because you've had to go live with another family member can be very traumatic. So we have very specific needs that perhaps they don't understand yet. And, you know, the bottom line, the cost for all of this is always a much concern. So we have a lot of educating to do.
And what can people not in West Virginia do to get these in their schools?
Well, I think that what they may not know is that they can be advocates for school-based health in their own communities, and it doesn't have to come from a principal, a superintendent. It can really come from the community itself. So go to a Board of Education meeting, say you want to see health care within your school, and then start pushing that momentum within your own community. It can be done. It doesn't have to come from that leadership.
Kelly Caseman is the executive director and a founding member of Think Kids in West Virginia. There are heroes everywhere. They're called moms. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Need to find a hero? Look to moms. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Scott Allison, professor of psychology at the University of Richmond, explores the four reasons for this.
Moms are indeed the mother of all heroes. According to surveys I've conducted, over 25% of Americans cite their mother as their number one hero. More than 60 years ago, psychologist Abraham Maslow proposed his famous hierarchy of human needs. Mothers are masters at helping their children meet this full range of human needs and fulfill the four important functions of a hero. Heroes provide defense and protection. They embody intelligence and wisdom. They model moral behavior, and they promote inspiration. First, mothers defend and protect. Amazing stories abound of mothers lifting enormous weights or even sacrificing their own lives. It is commonplace to see headlines about mothers saving and protecting their children. Second, mothers provide intelligence and wisdom. Scientists are beginning to uncover evidence suggesting that intelligence is inherited more from mothers than from fathers. Beyond this, mothers are committed to passing on wisdom to their children. Many of Americans' most cherished heroes credit their mothers for teaching them fundamental truths about life. Third, mothers are moral models. Children watch their mothers' selflessness and daily sacrifices and learn to perform these acts of kindness for others. Heroes are beacons of hope who demonstrate how to behave virtuously. Sounds like a lot of moms. Fourth, mothers enhance and inspire. Of all the people to pick from as heroes, presidents, humanitarians, legends, coaches, and family members, our survey respondents listed mothers as their number one hero. Mothers, we learned, meet people's needs and mold us into our best selves.
That was Scott Allison of the University of Richmond. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. Thank you.
Thank you.